Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September the 7th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Ina Berkey. Today's session number is BEL 2001-5, and the title of the session is The Church Year and the Sacraments. Let's listen to Ina.
Formed in the mid-1700s, and they have very much a pietistic element to them, as you can see if you read their text. But what is wonderful to us musicians is that they brought to this country a great heritage of music. And I was spouting off about how they're, you know, Winston-Salem, and not a soul in the class had ever heard of the Moravians. So that's why I went back to look. If you come to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, you'll find this, the area where they first settled, and brought with them this marvelous heritage of music. And we also said, oh, but don't you know the Moravian star, the beautiful Christmas ornament that I wish I had a picture to show you, and the Moravian Christmas cookies. And then I asked if any of you know if there are Moravians out this way, and nobody could think of any settlement of the Moravian community past about the Midwest. Anybody have anything to add to this? It says today that the Moravians are in North America, South America, Germany, and Britain, but that over half of them have settled in North America. So that's, and they usually live in community, and usually in rural areas. So they have some affinity with the Amish, and that's as much as I can bring you up to date about the Moravians, sometimes called the Moravian Brethren. I'm so happy you're here today. My name is Ina Berkey, and we are now in session 5 of a tour of the church year using hymns. We have done a whirlwind for the week, and today we're looking at hymns that go with our sacraments, the Lord's Supper and baptism. We said early on, why is it that we even bother with this hymn, with this liturgical year cycle? And we pointed out that everything has a cycle. I mean, if you were here Sunday night, you saw the full moon. And you know that the next day it's not going to be full. But you know in a very regular way the full moon comes again. We talked about some of our religious festivals that are based on the lunar cycle. We said that, hi, come on in, pick up 2 books, and come join us. We've got 2 chairs right here. This is not the front row. Everybody's on the
right
front
here.
We said that even our bodies have cycles. We call it biorhythms. And we know that we work best if we can figure out what that is. The only place I ever figure out what my sleep cycle is if I can get away to a place like this and let my body say, sleep, this is wonderful. Because I can promise you, in my daily life, my biorhythm sleep cycle is not doing too well. So today we move on to hymnody that has been written to amplify and help us celebrate the sacraments. We said that from the very earliest day of the Christians, we know that 2 things happened. That they worshiped every week on Sunday, and they gathered around word and supper. And this happened from the very earliest time. If you read some more of the writings that we've been studying in the evening with St. Paul's Journeys, you'll see in some readings that I'll reference in a moment that even from that earliest time, those are the 2 ways they gathered. In a very regular time, every week they came together for word and the supper. And once a year, they came together for that marvelous big celebration of Easter, which then, as the centuries went on, expanded to be a larger idea. And then we talked yesterday that it's only in this past century that Christ the King became a festival that was celebrated. Not that Christ the King wasn't always there, we just didn't give that kind of emphasis to it as the church. So today we want to go back then and pick up on baptism. And for this particular event, it goes back much further than anything we've talked about so far. We can trace this back to the earliest days of the Jewish community. You know that the Jewish male was in a very symbolic and obvious way at the 8th day circumcised in order to make the statement of being in covenant with God. So this is happening from as far back as we can remember. There's no question that, as you heard in the missionary journeys yesterday, that Paul was saying circumcision is okay, but it's not necessary for us as Christians, but it's not going to get in the way if that is the way you want to think about it. Now, as we get to the New Testament, we can certainly see that John the Baptist paved the way for the celebration of the baptism. Because you remember, what did he say about his being the baptizer? Remember, he said that I baptize you with water, but the one comes after me. And Jesus gave some importance to baptism by himself being baptized. If you think about baptism hymns, I thought we'd look first at a contemporary one, and it's wonderful that it was used at Matins this morning up in the dining hall, and I promise you we didn't plan it that way. 770 in your blue book. We've talked about our hymnody coming from many places over the last 2,000 years. We've tried to look at what some modern-day writers are writing, and we've also picked up on some hymns that came to us in the book from as early as the 3rd century. Now, what were our first hymns? We said hymnody goes much further back than that. What were we using for hymns in the Old Testament?
The Psalms.
The Psalms, the great hymns of the Old Testament that were always sung. And we try to, in many parishes, bring that idea back again by singing the Psalms. But that, our earliest hymnody, and then we've talked this week about some Christmas hymns, and we'll get to some others today that go back to the year in the 300s. But a contemporary writer, John Ilbesacher, and if you look him up in the back, you'll find that he has other hymns too. He wrote this one as a kind of an overview of the whole Christian life. And if you listen to him read the text this morning, sometimes it's so wonderful to read text because if you don't know the tune, you can get so busy trying to figure out how to sing the melody that you don't pay attention to the text. So it was very enlightening to hear him read this. How many of you know Born in Cry? And then I won't wax on about it. It's probably, I would guess, the hymn in this blue book, if you're in the Lutheran services, that's probably been most used out of this book. I can't prove that, but I'm sort of guessing that. John Ilbesacher is still alive and writing today.
Was he a minister?
No, he's not. He's just a hymn writer.
There was a Ilbesacher who was minister at the church where some of my cousins were.
You know, I don't think he...
But he would have been born before 1937.
He has always been music director. And so he was born in 1957. You can tell that by looking at... He was born in 37. He wrote this in 57. And he has been a music director at many churches, but in more recent years has stopped that to put his time full-time to writing. If you looked on the little teaser board up there, what in the world do you think water life was about? And where did I come up with that word? Well, we said that down here, besides at the bottom of your book, you can always look over here to see who wrote the text and when they were born, who wrote the tune and when they were born. And oftentimes, those will be different. A text writer will write the text, and some years later, somebody finds the text and says, "That's great, what should we do to sing it to?" And we've seen examples of pulling in a common folk song, or a song heard in the secular world, or sometimes somebody sits down and writes something that seems to go with that music. Today, in Born in Cry, Ilbesacher is so one of the talented kind who is able to sit down and write text and tune together. But over on this right-hand corner in all of your hymns and these hymn books are some other strange things. One, the top one, is the name of the hymn tune. Now, names of hymn tunes come from who knows where. We saw one yesterday, named Slain, and we looked to see that that's a hillside in Ireland. And maybe the person sitting on the hillside when they wrote the tune. I don't know. It's just as strange as that. We talked about a hymn tune yesterday named Nicaea, and that, we said, is because that tune and text was about the Trinity, and Nicaea, the council where they first affirmed the doctrine of the Trinity, so we can see why that is. But the hymn tune names are always kind of teasers to get you to figure out if you can. Sometimes it's simply a repetition of the title of the hymn. But sometimes it's something more obscure than that. So the name of this tune that Ilvesacker wrote is Water Life. And there's a door prize. Let's see if there's somebody that can hazard a guess, and then I'll tell you what he says about it.
Water and baptism?
Well, I think that's close enough. Do you know about the little Holden prayer rocks? I think these are so beautiful. If you don't know about them, you do now. He says that he was writing this to talk about the waters of baptism influencing and setting in motion our whole life. And so if you look at the rest of the text, you know the text. You heard the wonder of the word. If you find someone to share your time, the middle ages, not too old, no longer young, and yet one more surprise. So he's written this wonderful hymn for us that talks about baptism, but talks about baptism as it sets into play the whole rest of our life, for which he calls water life. Now, you see some numbers down there, and we probably ought to just run by that one more time. 989796D. Now, this is a way, and we've done some playing with this, but we won't stop to do it today, but this has to do with the meter of the phrases in the song. It says that out of that first phrase, we ought to be able to get 9 pulses. I was there to hear your morning cry. First phrase. I'll be there when you are gone. Should be 7, yes. And you can count it on out. Now, you wonder what we could use this for. And what might happen if it's a meter reading that's common enough, we found some that were 9, 8, 9, 8, 10, 9, and we couldn't find anything else that had that meter. But if you found another hymn that had the same marking here in the bottom, or you could look back to the index in the back and find out, it might give you a way to swap texts and hymn tunes. Let's say that on Sunday morning, the pastor says, I want to use this text. It goes with my sermon. And as the musician, I say, we've never seen that text before, nor have we seen that melody. So my mind says, it may be better that we try to concentrate on the text, so let's put it to the most familiar piece of music my congregation knows. Now, you can do this, and we've had some examples this week of ways that it works and how you have to be a little careful. It's not too good to just swap it without singing it out first. Of the Father's love begotten with the beautiful da 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 da. Well, that'll also work to the hymn tune for the Navy tune, but you don't want to sing of the Father's love. Anyway, if you'll turn over and see, you could swap those two, but you also have to be aware of what the tune sounds like, that you don't put majestic text to a very contemplative hymn tune. But that's what that's one use of the numbers down here, the meter.
It's fun that you can just plug in and get the tune and be right.
You can do that. It's something for you to do someday when you get to church an hour early and you look in the back. No, don't do it during the sermon. And you look to the metrical index for the tunes in the back of your hymn book, and then you can start to play this game. It's not just a game, but it is kind of fun to see what kinds of things you can swap back and forth. But back to baptism. We said there's no question that John the Baptist certainly set this in order with his baptism and then looking ahead to Christ. We know that Christ then identified baptism as being something important, but where in the New Testament is probably the most detailed glimpse we get of an early baptism? I'm raking things away there. Think about from an early time when Philip's going down the road and the eunuch stops him and they begin to talk, and the eunuch says to him, I'd really like to be baptized, and I think Philip probably says, well, sure, sometime. And about that time, they come to the water, and the eunuch says, but what's wrong with being baptized right here? And Philip, being astute and understanding what the eunuch's saying, they stop and have the baptism. The next verse that's often left out of translation has Philip saying, if you wholeheartedly believe, it's permitted. And at that point, the eunuch says, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. They go down into the water, and Philip and the eunuch are there, and he is baptized. And that in itself has all the elements for baptism that we even talk about today. The confession of Jesus as Lord, some water, depending on how much water. Really, Martin Luther says the amount of water doesn't make your baptism more or less. But here in the very beginning, the creedal statement about his faith, and then they go down into the water, Philip baptizes him, and it's still much the same today. Now, we talked about in the early church, baptism was a much more intensive kind of training time than, and might most appropriately be likened to our catechism instruction today. Except at that time, it was adults. They were in an extensive training period, and it always occurred ahead of the Easter celebration, so that they had been in very intense training for weeks, probably months, and that on the eve of the Easter vigil, that's when all the believers then were baptized for the first time in this great baptismal service of the Easter vigil. You remember that Peter then, on Pentecost, urged his hearers to accept baptism and assured them, even from that earliest time, that the gift of the Holy Spirit would be theirs. I wanted to look at a hymn that's out of the Green Book, 188, that just as Ilvesacher is very, very new, hymn 188 takes us back to a very, very early hymn text and tune. If you notice, this text is attributed to St. Patrick in the 300s. Now, in the Irish tradition, it says that this was probably inscribed on a breastplate that a person wore. And you remember that wonderful story we talk about St. Patrick, how he was in a great battle with the Druids. And the Druids had decided to have a great time of celebration when they were going to put all the fires of the kingdom out. And in defiance, St. Patrick lit the Paschal candle. Well, you can imagine a fight that ensued, and they were given, St. Patrick and his men were given chase by the Druids with the intention of killing him. And the legend goes that somehow miraculously they were changed to look like that they were deer. And that the Druids came and saw the deer instead of the men and didn't kill them, thus they were saved. And if you go back to a hymn we used earlier this week, Be Thou My Vision, and that out of the Irish time, if you look back at that another time, you can see that that too is attributed with St. Patrick and this idea of the vision that somehow they were miraculously saved because the Druids looked at them and thought they were deer. It's a good legend. So if you look down then at the bottom of the hymn tune and see the name of this hymn tune at St. Patrick's breastplate, then you can put back into your mind the idea of what this must mean. Instead of calling this tune, I bind this day to me, I bind it to myself today, it's called St. Patrick's breastplate because there is the Irish folklore that this probably was written on St. Patrick's breastplate. Look at the imagery for baptism on this. You do the refrain over and over again, I bind unto myself today the strong name of the Trinity. By invocation of the same, the three in one and one in three. And then you turn the page and repeat the verses here, and much more imagery about baptism. I bind this day to me forever by power of faith, Christ's incarnation, his baptism, his cross, his bursting from the spice tomb, his riding up the heavenly way. And so we get the whole history of Jesus there. The virtues of the starlit heavens, the glorious sun-giving ray. I bind myself with the power of God to hold and lead. I bind myself the name, the strong name of the Trinity. This actually was often directed in the monasteries of Ireland to be used as the hymn that went with the baptismal service. So this comes to us from a long history as a baptismal hymn, and it's certainly very early, 372. We've only looked at one other hymn that was written earlier than this for the text. The text is written in 372. In the 1800s, someone translates the text for us and then sets it to an Irish tune of the time called St. Patrick's Breastplate. Man, that is a tough word to say. In the Western Church, this intense preparation for baptism was always the weeks before Easter, and then they were baptized at the vigil of Easter. It's even that way today, and I mentioned earlier that many churches are trying to get back to the idea of a longer preparation for baptism. The catechumenate study may be a word that you've heard, or you may hear. You may never hear. But you'll know if you do that this is the idea of trying to bring back from the past the idea of a very intensive study for new members to the faith. And it says that they didn't just end with that. Once they were baptized in that great service of fire and water and readings, then that their study continued after that. Now, in more recent centuries, we've appropriated that in our catechetical instruction. By the 16th century, Luther felt that baptism was clouded by all kinds of other ceremonies, and he discarded most of everything that was extraordinary out of his baptismal rite in the 1500s. He did like the prayer that we have talked about consistently with, that's consistent with Peter's lectures. You know, the prayer in our, and let me give you a page number here because I, well, yes. Back in the front of your book, 69. We'll get to this prayer when we get to the communion service, but in the baptismal service, we also have this prayer that recounts the whole history. In the prayer that comes into our communion service on page 69, early in the book, you fill creation through Abraham you promised, through the prophets you promised, and that leads right into the communion service. We have the same kind of prayer that brings us into the baptismal service. There is a prayer on page 201. Yeah, this is context and how fast you can turn pages. So why is it that I'm not seeing what I think I'm seeing here? We're going to. Now that you found that, I'm going to say, wait a minute. I want to look at one more baptismal hymn, and then we'll move on to Holy Communion. If you look at 6, 9, 8 in the blue book. You need 6 hands for this one.
Wow, this is an awful lot of looping and shuffling paper.
It makes you just think you're right there again, doesn't it?
What number did you say?
698. Again, another Ilvesacher hymn, and another of his baptismal hymns that he's put both text and music together. We were baptized in Christ Jesus. We were baptized in his death. And if we have been united in a dreadful death like his, we will all be reunited, for he lives. Where have you heard that kind of wording before? The united in the death like his, to be reunited, for he lives. We'll get to it later then. I won't make you answer that right now. I'd like to then look. We'll move from baptism, that earliest of times when the Christians were prepared for their entry into the way, long preparation, culminating on the Easter Vigil. And then we have said that from the earliest time, the other thing that the Christians most gathered around was every Sunday when they gathered for word and the meal. Now,
when was it that baptism changed from the preparation, you know, to the child being baptized? Is that a Luther thing, or was that?
Child baptism and infant baptism is still something that varies denomination to denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, Martin Luther seemed to think that that was a very important thing as early as possible, and with the parents taking on the promises that the child would be instructed in the faith. There are many people now in many denominations who still do it exactly the opposite to that, in that they don't feel that a person's able to be baptized until they're old enough to understand what they're doing and saying. And we'll get to that in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper too, because we still have that same kind of controversy about which is right, where should we be doing this, even today. What are some words that you've heard or that your church may use to describe the Lord's Supper, besides the Lord's Supper?
Communion.
Communion, sometimes Holy Communion. In fact, if you look at the top of the headings of this next section of hymns here, it calls it Holy Communion.
Eucharist.
Some churches call it the breaking of the bread. What does the Catholic Church call it? I mean, the Mass is the service of communion. I'd like to look at the very earliest piece that is based on a text, 704. You're still in the blue book, so you don't have to go very far. Now, sometimes you may wonder, how do we know all these things? Who said? I mean, how do I know what they were doing in the year 200? And so if you look down to here, you'll see reference to the earliest written book that we have that talked about the form of the church and the practices of the church. It's a wonderful word that is really, I think, pronounced the Didache. And it's a word down at the bottom of that page that says in the second century. So as early as the second century, we're seeing written down ideas for what makes the worship together, and kind of a book of how to and what to. And in that book, it had written down the text similar to this for this hymn. Father, we thank you that you planted your holy name within our hearts. Knowledge and faith immortal, Jesus your Son to us imparts. Lord, you have made all for your pleasure and given food for all our days. Giving in Christ the bread eternal, yours is the power, yours the praise. So the text of this, the words that we see here, really come to us out of one of our earliest Christian writings in the years of the 200s. So this is quite old. And then you look to see that in the 1500s, the music then was added by a French writer, and therefore that's probably why the hymn tune, Rendez à Dieu. If you know your French, who wants to translate that for me?
Something of God, rendering of God, or a
And it is glory, praise.
Praise to God.
Mm-hmm.
The person who wrote this was responsible for writing many, many hymn tunes that mostly were used with the Psalms. He wrote a whole book of Psalm tunes. And then also put this earliest Christian writing to a hymn tune that he wrote. Do you want to hear how this sounds? And then he repeats it. example of a text from 200 being put to music in 1500 by a Frenchman, and this then comes to us again in this book. We didn't have it in any of our previous hymnals, but an idea of a new communion hymn. If you look in your green book at 203, you'll get an idea of a hymn that was written much earlier, although the text and the tune really come out of a much more recent time. 203 in the green book. The tune, Johann Kruger, a very prolific writer of marvelous hymn tunes, and Schmucke Dick, what do you think that says? Come on, you German scholars, help me out here.
Of mine.
They're waiting for a door prize. Do you use this at all in your... many composers picking up these tunes and using them for further music. This, you will find our dear friend Mr. Bach again, has taken the hymn tune and done numerous editions of this, both as organ music and as basis for some of his other writings. If you think about the Lord's Supper, not only does it go back to the institution of the Lord's Supper by the Lord, but if you think about it ahead of that, there's much in Jewish history upon which this builds. Think for a moment about the times in the Jewish life that were built around the temple from as early as the 7th century B.C. The communion text people then picked up that from that earliest time, the idea of the blood of the covenant shed for many. The synagogue also had daily public prayer as a predecessor to the Christians gathering every week. And the family meal that was part of the Passover celebration and the Jewish meal every day that the Jewish person and family gathered together was a holy meal. It's interesting that if the Last Supper was, in fact, celebrated as part of the Passover, and there's pretty good reason to think that's so, then Jesus appropriated what was already very important and very much ritual to the Jewish family to institute yet a different meaning to what the Lord's Supper is. If you think about the fact that he transformed this, where Jews prayed that the Messiah would appear, then taking this very idea of the Passover Supper to exemplify that, in fact, Jesus has come and is in your very midst. If you'd like to look at another contemporary setting of a music text, look at 7032 in your blue book, and many of you may have sung this in your parishes. It's new to us in this book.
Which number?
702. Now here the hymn tune name is called the same as the text, as the name of the song, I Am the Bread of Life. Suzanne Tulan is a teacher. She was writing and one day wrote this down and thought, oh, this isn't too good. So she tore it up, threw it in the wastebasket, and one of her students, I don't know why she was looking in the wastebasket, but she did, and came back to Susan and said, this is really wonderful. Why were you throwing this away? So the story goes that Suzanne thought, well, maybe she should take another look, pulled it out of the garbage can, scotch taped it back together, and lived with it for a while and began to think that perhaps it really was a worthy text. And she then has written the tune to go with it. The first three verses in particular are very strong Holy Communion texts. the bread of life, you will not hunger. The bread I give is my flesh for the life of the world, and if you eat this bread, you'll live forever. If you eat of the flesh of the Son of Man and drink of his blood, you shall not have life within you, and I will raise you up. And here again, we get to that imagery of not just today, but the fact of the coming of Christ again, when we are raised up into the last day. So I'm glad that her students pulled this out of the wastebasket. Do you know the tune for this? It's just quite different, so I'll just play the refrain for you. The music for Spukadik to now the feast that we looked at just a little bit ago. Let me go back to that document that we talked about in the 200s and hear what it says about how to celebrate the Lord's Supper. It listed in it a very strict warning about not giving communion to the unbaptized. It had instructions on how to be reconciled to your neighbor before you came to the communion table. And the famous line out of that year 200 document said, "As this piece of bread was scattered on the hills and then brought together and made one, so let your church on earth be brought together from the ends of the earth into your kingdom." Have you ever heard those words before? Well, it's interesting to me that those words have been appropriated in recent times and come back to us in hymnody. If you've sung Marty Haugen's Now the Feast and Celebration, you know that those words are there. Look at 705 here. In fact, we talked that Marty Haugen is like David Haas from the Gather Book this morning, a very prolific hymn writer and liturgy text tune writer at this time. One of his beautiful things that we do here at the Village, the Holden Evening Prayer, was written by Marty Haugen in celebration of the text of the Vesper service for this very place. But he's also written a wonderful communion setting called Now the Feast and Celebration. And if you've used that, you've sung this. If you haven't used that whole setting, you may have sung it out of this book. But think about those words out of that year 200 document, and here it comes. As the grains of wheat, once scattered on the hill, were gathered in one to become our bread, so may all your people from all the ends of earth be gathered to you. If you look at the next page with the two verses, he talks about the cup of blessing and a foretaste of all that is to come. Here again, we see this imagery of not just now, but looking ahead. You know, as we use our communion services, particularly in the Lutheran service, and that's not to say that you don't do, I don't know all of your backgrounds, but often in a Lutheran service, we will use that very text. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. We sometimes say those very three things as part of the preparation for communion. The fact of looking back to the resurrection, the day that they celebrated from the very earliest time, to the fact that Christ is risen and that Christ will come again. And you get a lot of that in this text here. This is as the grains of wheat. And if you just turn over three more pages to 708, this hymn writer has also picked up the grains of wheat. Now, this is a hymn out of the Spanish tradition. But once again, grains of wheat, gilded by the sun, purple clusters collected from the vine. And we could sing it in Spanish, but I didn't. I promised you that I wouldn't make you sing, so I won't do that. New Eucharistic prayers go back to trace our history, just like Peter talked about this morning. And if you look back at, let's look in the front of the Green Book, back to page 69. Now, you know, if you're out of the Lutheran tradition, probably prior to this Green Book, often often at communion you heard just the words of institution. That's that red number there, 32. You got to the communion service, you took the offering, and then the pastor stood up and said, in the night when he was betrayed, he took bread and wine. And that was the version there. And as we said, liturgy is always in a chant, in a process of being reformed and to look at history and see what may add some clarification to it. So in this book, we then add a Eucharistic prayer option that does this whole history thing that we talked about with Peter, where we look back to see where we came from and how that we are a line of so great a line of witnesses. Look at the prayer there that often will prepare us for communion on page 69. Holy God, you have filled all creation with light and life. Through Abraham you promised to bless the nations. You rescued Israel. Through the prophets you renewed your promise. You sent your Son, who in word and deeds proclaimed your kingdom and was obedient to your will, even to giving his life. Then the words of blessing for the bread and wine. And then we have those words that we as a congregation often say there. Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. And believing the witness of his resurrection, we await his coming in power to share with us the great and promised feast. So, in a way, if you don't get too hung up on time, this gives you a beautiful way of understanding that the Eucharist is part of a long history, a long time of covenant with God from the very earliest times. And this reminds us of our place, that we aren't just people today remembering Jesus and the Last Supper, but we are part of a long line of witnesses going all the way back to Abraham and before, and how this is passed down generation to generation. We talked a bit earlier about the idea that Pope John the 23rd and the Vatican reform has done much to help us with our liturgy celebration. We said that for this moment in time, for the first time, all Catholics and most Protestants are following the set of texts that are all the same. And to him we also owe a great bringing back again many of the texts. It was out of that council that the idea of adding that Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again has been added to really give much greater impact to our services of Holy Communion. You know, for us, it's very interesting that it probably depends on how you were brought up or how your idea of communion is. If you want to share for a minute, tell me from your own personal experience, for you, is the Eucharist a time of joy or a time of great repentance, or what is the mood of communion?
I think it was a kind of controversial thing in our church. It used to be, you know, you would have communion maybe two or three times a year and then on the special holidays. And when it went to once a week, you know, every Sunday, initially we thought, yeah, this is just going to be routine and there's not going to be much meaning. But I think, you know, it's become hard, and we miss communion if we don't have it. So.
Yeah. What about the mood of the... Is it really a feast and celebration?
I think so.
Yes.
Well, I find it very spiritual, but I had an interesting thing happen to me. My son married a Catholic lady that we adore, and we sometimes, you know, at Christmas would go to church in the Catholic church, and that was not part of my background. And she would come up to our Lutheran church on the islands, and, you know, she participated in our communion, and I went down there and participated in hers, and didn't know any difference. And then I had a friend about my age that said, "You can't do that." Oh my gosh, you know? And so I said to my daughter, I said, "Why didn't you say something?" And she said, you know, Karen, I didn't see anything because I don't think God cares.
I mean, that was just wonderful.
Well, so much of I think that the mood of how we feel personally has something to do with our own response to our own spirituality. And I'm not saying one way is better or worse. I mean, you can make the case that going to communion should leave you dancing down the aisles with the joy of the forgiveness and this moment. But, you know, I think that there has been a time in the past centuries where we've been much more comfortable telling God what great sinners we are than celebrating the joy of this celebration. And I'm not saying it's either, maybe a bit of both. But certainly a lot of the hymn text writing that's happening now seems to focus a bit more on the joy and the celebration of the Eucharist instead of the... Well, I'm not going to quote that hymn because that's probably your favorite hymn.
What is the correct thing to do? I've been in that situation too, and you know, I don't go up for communion in a Catholic church if I ever visit. But I mean, is it a no-no, or you should not do it or participate?
I just usually hope that either in the bulletin or in the remark, somebody will tell me what to do.
Well, my experience just recently, I had a granddaughter whose twins were baptized, so we all went to the service, and in the front of their book it said that, you know, you mm-hmm. have your options. They didn't tell you couldn't. Mm-hmm. And I went up for communion. I was the only one, and my daughter and her husband didn't go, but I did. I think it's
I think it depends on the church.
Yeah.
Well, that may be.
You know, we've been in some. Our son was married in a Catholic church, and there were a lot of Lutherans there. The priest invited everyone forward. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My sister was at a wedding right before we came out. That priest said only believing Catholics.
Oh, no, that was not stated in the service.
You know, unfortunately, we're having this happen to us in our Lutheran churches. Mm-hmm. You know, and it has not so much to do with whether you're Lutheran, but what kind you are, which is rather distressing to some.
Now, in our church, everyone is
invited. Yes.
We see those who, if you believe, you're
having the bulletin is always the very first announcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is certainly... a more welcoming way to be, I suppose. But we could talk about that.
Years ago, did they sign in?
Yes,
kind of?
Yes, and you had to come to a confession time on Saturday, didn't you?
Yeah,
and
then
for Sunday?
You fasted. A lot of them, I know, fasted before they went.
In the Catholic Church, you're talking about?
Well,
even
Lutheran.
In the Missouri Synod.
Missouri Synod,
is that right?
Wisconsin.
And, you know, it's not whether these things are right or wrong. I think we get into a lot of trouble with that. But,
right.
But I think that it may be more asking the question, what helps you in your spiritual life? And if it's fasting and confession, and if that's what amplifies and makes the Lord's Supper more important for you, then we're not to say that that's not good for you. But then again, if I want to jump down the aisle afterwards because I'm so filled with celebration and joy, then perhaps we have to be open to what is the response for each of us.
Hymn 789, Now the Feast and Celebration, is that sung during... I mean, I'm familiar with it, but is it sung during communion or is it sung after communion? Or are we now the feast and celebration?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
All creation.
Are we back? Coming to number
789.
In the now in the feast liturgy, that's the earlier in the service.
It's during. He wrote that as part of his setting of liturgy called Now the Feast and Celebration. And is this the hymn of praise?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At the point where in. If you're familiar with Green Book, where you might be singing
This is the Feast,
or you might be singing Glory to God, this is his, this is another setting of a text that's appropriate for the phrase. And this, too, is out of that, the same one as the grains of wheat come out of that same setting. Well, we've had a wonderful time together this week talking about the rhythm of life and the rhythm of our church year. The fact that the rhythm of the church year gives some structure to how we go from the first Sunday of Advent through Easter and through to the end of the church year, Christ the King. A way of looking at how we celebrate and the way that hymn writers have been writing and celebrating the text of these times since the earliest time. We've looked at hymns from year 300. We've looked at hymns from year 1987 to see that it's a glorious hymnody that amplifies what we do. We have this wonderful program back on the East Coast called Desert Disc. And a person is invited to come in and say, you know, if you're going on the desert island, what 10 discs will you take with you, CDs? And I've often thought, how would you answer that if you were going to the desert island and you could take 3 books? Well, I would tell you that for me, if I couldn't take my hymn book with me, I'd be greatly bereft, because out of the hymn book, we're able to sing our faith. The psalms are there. Many of these texts are direct quotes or paraphrases of the Bible. And I'm just very, very sure that singing our faith has something to say about it. I loved it when Peter said the other night that often he didn't go away singing the sermon, but he certainly did go away singing the hymn. And that's not an either-or thing, but it is something to think about how important hymnody is in our development and in the development of our faith of our children. I am so sure that children must be taught to sing their faith. We all said to each other in some of the settings this week, well, you know, the Lord's, you know, the 23rd Psalm, man, I can say that going down, my image was, that's what I say to myself when I'm on the gurney going to surgery. You know, but what are our children going to say? Are we giving them the hymns of the faith that will give them the sustenance and the power that they need? I'd love to recommend this book to you, but it's not in the, it didn't come either, but you know, they did their best. But it's called How Can I Keep From Singing? And I want to read from this book that is quoting Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in fact. Why do Christians sing when they're together? And Bonhoeffer said the reason's quite simply because in singing together, it's possible for them to speak and pray the same word at the same time. In other words, because here they can unite in the word. It's the voice of the church that is heard in singing together. It's not you that sings. It's the church that's singing, and you as a member of the church may share in its song. Thus all singing together that is right must serve to widen our spiritual horizon, make us see our little company as a member of the great Christian church on earth, and help us willingly and gladly to join our singing, be it feeble or good, to the song of the church. How can I keep from singing? Bonhoeffer answers, if baptized, you can't. If you've cast your lot with this church, if you've been hounded inside, you can't. Our ritual song is our rehearsal for life. And so I just have enjoyed so much sharing with you this wonderful hymnody that we have. I'm going to close with one hymn in the blue book, 721. And I was doing this before Peter closed with the hymn this morning. Here again, we've seen another of Vita's hymn text this week, but mostly I chose this because it's a beautiful setting as a hymn of dismissal. If you don't know it, maybe you should, and I'm thinking that you may know the melody because it's come to us from the Welsh. Tell me another tune that you sing to this. It really came to us early on as All Through the Night. Yeah. And if you, out of the Green Book, if you're familiar with that, you have sung God That Made the Earth and Heaven. But I'd like to close with this, and then we're going to go on a little tour. We still have time. This is today's music by Vita, the wonderful composer. If you look in the back, you'll see others with a hymn tune, Welsh. And there's the Welsh name of this tune, and I'm not going to get close to that. I don't know how to say it. But some of you may. Just say. say the words to yourself, God doesn't care. But this is a hymn that I'd like us to dismiss with. That expresses so much the beauty of one who calls us by name. I've enjoyed so much spending the week with you.